Mark's in St. Mark's. He is the Chancellor of the Diocese of Wichita and the Judicial Vicar for the Diocese. Father Brian Nielsen was ordained March 24th of 2003.
May 24th of 2003.
He's had a variety of different assignments over the years. He received his JCL, right?
Yep.
From the Catholic University of America in 2012. He has served as pastor of St. Mark's since 2015. He is a judge of the judicial vicar and the chancellor for the diocese, and he serves along with yours truly on Bishop's leadership team. Let's welcome Father Brian Nielsen.
And I graduated in 2015.
Oh, you went in 2012.
Yeah. Any chance I get to correct Father Pat, I All right. So I was speaking to Father David Leese earlier today, and he asked if what I was doing this evening, and I told him. And he said, "Oh, what are you talking about?" I said, "I'll give you one guess." And he sat there in silence for a moment, and he said, "They're not going to make you talk about canon law, are they?" Indeed. So here we are talking about canon law. So, the question of marriage and annulments. This typically tends to be a topic where people have lots of questions. So I'm going to give an overview to start with, cover a few parts of this, and then we'll open it up to questions. And if you don't have questions, I have things that I can fill the next 5 hours with. So, nobody really wanted to watch the game, right? All right. So, I refer to this, the Code of Canon Law, as the other holy book, all right? So, I carry it with me at least as often as I have a Bible. And that is actually the sad truth. Okay. So here is how the Code of Canon Law defines marriage. Prepare to be enthralled. The matrimonial covenant by which a man and a woman establish between themselves a partnership of the whole of life, and which is ordered by its nature to the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring, has been raised by Christ the Lord to the dignity of a sacrament between the baptized. For this reason, this is paragraph 2, by the way, a valid matrimonial contract cannot exist between the baptized without it being, by that fact, a sacrament. Okay, so this is the very first canon on marriage. And I meant to look this up, so I had these numbers just like really handy for me, but I don't, so we're gonna do it this way. But there is a section in the Code of Canon Law for each of the sacraments. So baptism starts with Canon 849, and it goes to Canon 878. Marriage starts with Canon 1055, and it goes to Canon 1165. So you see that as far as like how this gets laid out, it gets a little complicated sometimes. So I'm not going to sit here and read all of the canons to you. You're welcome. But it's important to know that there is a lot that goes into this. So just like we have with any other sacrament, you have matter and form for the sacrament of marriage. And matter, we know that. So the partnership between a man and a woman, there you go. And form is the exchange of consent before two witnesses and the witness of the church. Okay, so that is simply how we would look at the sacrament itself. Okay, so when it comes to annulments, what we are looking at is, was there a valid exchange of consent or not? Okay, so there are two main reasons by which we explore this question. So it's, they're either invalid for because of a defect of form, or they're invalid because of a defect of consent. So defect of form, we talked about briefly what that form is. It, of course, is more complicated than just the simple explanation that I gave. And a defect of consent. Those are the two basic reasons. Now, there are a lot of things that fall underneath each one of those, perhaps more so under a defect of consent than under defect of form. But those are the two basic reasons why a marriage might be invalid. So the question is, how do we get to that point of understanding? The church has what we call a presumptio iuris, so a presumption of law, that a marriage is valid until proven otherwise. Okay? So that is always our starting assumption, that the marriage in question is valid. And so a person who is approaching the tribunal and wanting to receive an annulment needs to give us reasons for us to consider this marriage to be invalid. Now, they might not understand all of the nuances of what they're giving to us, but they're going to have to provide us with information. And many people have a really hard time understanding that part. And sometimes I just want to smack them, all right? But I don't. That's why I have a secretary who deals with the people, so. But we have people that come and they'll say, well, I mean, I don't know what's taking so long. I told you it's invalid. Well, thank you for your expert opinion. We don't care. Or we have people that think that they can, actually, this has happened recently in the last couple weeks. People have asked Cheryl, the secretary, how much is it going to cost me to get this done faster? And when Cheryl's being nice, which she is most of the time, except for to me, she will explain to them that that's not how this works. When she's not being nice, she will inform them she is insulted. And she may tell them, like, I'm just going to set your case aside for a while. I've only heard her tell one person that. I stood by her decision in that regard. Anyway, so those are the two basic reasons, okay? As we go through the course of the questions of consent, there are lots of things that come into play. So questions about whether a person was capable of placing consent, whether a person excluded some of one of the elements of that are essential for a marriage to be valid, or whether there was some external factor that played a role in that. All of those things have to be examined, and at the end of this, then a decision is made. So the process, typically, people begin with their parish priest. And we have to realize and understand first and foremost that this is a legal process. So because it is a legal process, what we are actually engaging in is a canonical trial. So this is a court proceeding in which there is, officers of the court, if you want. So we have a judge. There is what we call the defender of the bond. Our main defender of the bond likes to describe his role as providing the reasons that we should consider a marriage to be valid, and quality control. So that's his description of what he does. But the defender's job is to say, this is what the law says, and we should uphold the law. Okay? You have typically the parish priest of the person who's asking is going to serve as their advocate. It doesn't have to be their parish priest. It could be somebody else that they would like to approach, another priest perhaps, but he's going to be their advocate. And then it ultimately comes down to the judge. Now, it's not a court proceeding like we're used to seeing, you know, if you've been to court or seeing on TV. They never gave me a gavel, unfortunately. I'm sure everybody in the Chancery building is happy that I don't have a gavel. Most of what we do is on paper. So we don't gather everybody together. We don't sit everybody down at one time. It is theoretically possible, but it's not how most tribunals function. And that's not even how it's designed to function in the Code of Canon Law. So there are various stages that happen through this. I'm not going to bore you with all of the minute details of each stage, but each stage we're looking at relevant questions. So one of the stages is to determine what are the appropriate grounds for this to be considered under. Almost always when we're talking about grounds, we're talking about defective consent, okay? We have to notify the parties at various points and give them the opportunity to respond. We have to give them the opportunity to add to what has been provided to us or to respond to what has been provided to us. And then sometimes we also will be looking at finding some other information or evidence. Unlike a court system here, a judge in the canonical system is not limited to what has been presented to him. The judge can look at this and say, I think we need to find out what this person has to say about this, or we need to find this information about this. And the judge is free to pursue any of that activity. It's not just like, well, their attorneys didn't provide this, and so therefore it's not there. The judge can go and pursue this. Because ultimately, the goal of this process is to discern the truth. It is not an infallible process. So the judge can make a mistake, but the judge's job or role in this is to discern the truth. And when he does so, he's doing this under a standard of judgment, right? So if you look at criminal proceedings in the United States, our standard of judgment is that they're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, right? That's the standard of judgment. Civil cases might typically be a preponderance of the evidence, okay? So that's the standard of judgment. Our standard of judgment is moral certainty. So the judge needs to be morally certain that this marriage was invalid for him to rule affirmatively in that case and to grant the annulment. Okay. If the judge does not reach moral certitude in the case, then he must give it a negative decision, which then upholds the presumption of the law that the marriage is valid. Okay. After a judgment has been made, the parties have the opportunity to appeal. So appeal is possible. There was a change in the law in 2016, so I had just barely graduated before change, that used to be an automatic appeal for every affirmative decision. Pope Francis removed that automatic appeal. He did several other things when he changed the law there, but that was one of them. And so now the only reason that a case goes to appeal is if one of the parties actually appeals the case. The defender of the bond is also able to appeal a case. The judge cannot, obviously it's his decision, so he's not going to appeal it. If I was not the judge on a case, because I am not the judge on every case, we do have other judges, as the judicial vicar, I don't have the right to appeal a case just because I think the judge made a bad decision. It's either one of the two parties or the defender of the bond are the only people that have the right to appeal the case. Our normal appellate tribunal is Kansas City. So if somebody were to appeal a case that comes before us, and either they don't specify or they ask for it, it goes to Kansas City. They do also have the option of appealing it directly to the Roman Rota, which is in Rome, so that is possible. If it were to have gone to second instance in Kansas City and it gets appealed again, it would automatically then go to the Rota because there is no third instance tribunal in the United States. So that is the process in a very, very, very brief nutshell. I did not give all of the absolute details there. If you really want them, I'll give them to you, but I wanted to provide lots of room for questions. So, do you have any questions? If not, we'll go back in and I will start breaking some things down, but, yeah. Percentage of affirmatives and negatives. I don't know off the top of my head, but one thing to think about is that not every case makes it to judgment. Sometimes a party will appeal or will withdraw the case before us. Sometimes it never makes it beyond them talking to their parish priest. And so they just don't ever, I mean, how many cases do you have that just sit on your desk that people like never come back and do anything with? A lot. I mean, I have cases that I started when I was first ordained in 2003 that just nobody's ever done anything else with. But once they get to the tribunal, some cases end up just sort of sitting there and nothing happens with them.
Okay.
So there is a process by which if there's no activity in a case over a certain period of time, then the case is abated. So some of the cases go to abatement and they don't have a judgment that's made in them. So I don't know all of the details with all of those various pieces, which ones come to affirmatives or negatives themselves, but of the ones that actually end up with us, more are affirmative than negative. Sometimes people will say, well, do you ever give negatives? Yes, negatives do happen. So it's an interesting ordeal sometimes, but yeah.
Yeah, so typically when somebody appeals it, is it because they have a written report to see who you interviewed and maybe there were some other people that should have been interviewed or some other documentation that maybe they thought you missed that typically applies to it?
No, the appeal is typically because they disagreed with the decision that we reached. So we have several cases that have gone off to appeal recently, fairly recently, we are also an appellate tribunal for Kansas City and for Salina, so we get cases from them on appeal. You know, we just got one in last week that came from Salina. It was a negative decision, and so the petitioner didn't like that because they wanted to get this annulment, so they appealed to us. And then we had one that was an affirmative decision that was given, and the petitioner was happy with that decision, but the respondent said, no, I think this marriage was valid. I believe this marriage was valid. I don't believe that it was an invalid marriage. And so they appealed the decision. And then people do weird things sometimes. I had a case one time that came to us as an appeal. It was an affirmative decision. The respondent is the one who made the appeal. So I presume, when I see that, that that person believes that the marriage is valid and they're trying to stand by that. But when I started reading their letter, I realized, no, they wanted this annulment too, which, by the way, they had already, right? But they appealed the decision because they didn't like the grounds. It was a very poor decision on their part, because I looked at it and went, I don't know how the judge came to an affirmative decision in this case, but sure, go ahead. And they ended up, we overturned it. So we got a negative decision with us, and they no longer had the annulment that they had already gotten. I said, you were given a gift before. You should have just taken this and ran with it. And they didn't appeal it after that. So it stopped. I have no idea. But the reality is that they, if they didn't like the grounds, they should have raised that question when the grounds were set. Said, we think this should be on these grounds. That could have been revised and revisited at that moment, but not at the end. So, like I said, people do strange things. At that point, I'm like, okay, if you think the marriage is invalid, why does it matter what the grounds we decided on? Because I'm sure they didn't really understand them anyways. But people do strange things. Sometimes people will appeal that they think that maybe they're not even Catholic. And they, well, we had one, this person didn't appeal with the way it's set up. They're like, they were already in another marriage. They weren't Catholic. And they were very, very, very hung up on the question of their children. And I hear this a lot. People say, well, if we get an annulment, this says that our children are bastards. And I'm like, it doesn't. The law actually explicitly states that the decision of an annulment has no effect upon the status of the children. That is stated in our law, and we tell them that, and they still can't. They're like, no, this happened. The other thing that people will object to sometimes is that somebody told them that an annulment means that it's like this never happened. And that also is not true. We do not ignore the passage of time. We do not ignore the fact that there are children present. We do not ignore the fact that you have a common life together for however long it may have been. All of those things are still valid and relevant. The only question we are concerned with is, did you validly enter into this marriage at the time of consent or not? Okay? Because all of that time would be what we would call a fugitive marriage. So it's presumed to be valid because of the law until we prove that it wasn't. Okay? So we're not discounting any of that. So that idea that this says it's like it never happened, it is erroneous. Okay? And that gets people tripped up sometimes because they're like, no, I lived there. I experienced this. I went through whatever hell we went through, or whatever it was, the good times and the bad. The other objections that we end up with sometimes are people who say, I don't want him or her to get this annulment because in their minds, in their view, this person was responsible for the downfall of this marriage, and they want to get married again, and so if you give them an annulment, you are rewarding their bad behavior. And I get that. Sometimes that they give us that objection long before, not even for an appeal, they're just, as we're going through the case, and it's as if they're giving us all of the evidence we need to prove that this marriage was not valid. Like, okay, thank you for all of that information, but you are just adding fuel to this fire. And so I have to try and help them make a distinction between saying that this marriage, the first marriage, their marriage, was valid or not, and whether or not this other person should get married again. I'm not sitting there dealing with the person in far as the second question goes. And that's not really our role. Our role is to examine the question of the validity of the marriage that's being examined. So, all right. That was kind of a long roundabout, but other questions? Yes.
So, two-part question. First question, it's true that not both parties do not need to be baptized in order to enter into marriage to the Catholic Church. Is that correct?
Okay, so the question, do both parties need to be baptized to enter into marriage in the Catholic Church? The answer to that is both yes and no. So there are what we call impediments to marriage, okay? So marrying a person who is not baptized is an impediment to marriage, okay? So in order for you to marry a non-baptized person, you need a dispensation from what is called disparity of cult. So as long as the two parties got married with a dispensation from disparity of cult, then it is a valid marriage. But it is not sacramental. Okay? So it's not sacramental. It is a valid, real marriage, but not sacramental, because a valid matrimonial contract cannot exist between the baptized without it therefore being a sacrament. So, that would be a place where we could pursue a question of defect of form if they were to come to us afterwards. So we'll have that sometimes. A case comes in and I see, because our paperwork is extensive and it asks a lot of different questions for all of these reasons, because there's lots of things that get factored into this that people don't necessarily understand. So we ask all the questions so that we can sort through it, and I'll see that, you know, this person was baptized, this person was not baptized, and then I will ask, did they have a dispensation from disparity of cult? If they didn't have a dispensation from disparity of cult, I can end this very quickly. But if they did, and they most likely did, then we go on and proceed with it the way it is. But, yeah. Okay?
Yep.
Neither party receives the sacrament.
Correct. Neither party receives the sacrament of marriage. Now, if the other party becomes baptized at some point in the marriage, then it becomes a sacramental marriage. Yeah. Yeah.
So in that particular case, why would the church not encourage that individual to get baptized before he married him? As opposed to the dispensation.
Oh, well, I mean,
it seems like a backdoor way of getting them married.
Well, it's not a backdoor way of getting married. I mean, it's a legitimate process, but the question is, we don't want to coerce somebody into baptism just so that they, because there is a misconception out there that, well, we can't get married in the church because one is not baptized. Well, you can, and the church would encourage baptism, but we're not going to force that on them either. I mean, I'm doing marriage preparation with couples right now where one party is Catholic, the other party is unbaptized, and we've had conversations about it, but I'm not going to, you know, twist their arm and say, well, one of them right now, I think he will, actually, but I don't think he will before they get married. You know, he's still asking questions. Yeah. Which is not a bad place to be. Yeah.
Is there any statistics in what happens those that are denied, but do you have any ability to follow up?
We do not follow up with them. No. That would be the place of their parish priest.
Okay, well, there's a place. I'm curious what effect that has.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this case has just stood out to me for a long time. We had one that came, the woman is the one who was petitioning for the annulment, received a negative decision. She did not appeal it, but as we were having, she called in questioning whether she should, so she was talking to Cheryl, and in the course of it, she told Cheryl that she was pursuing this because her former spouse had gotten married outside the church to somebody else, and she wanted him to be able to enter into a valid marriage with somebody else. I'm like, I thought, I mean, that's pretty heroic on her part. She had no intention of getting remarried. But I have no idea what happened beyond that, because that was our last contact with her. So.
Is everybody explained why it's a negative decision? Do they get explanations?
We give them a very brief. Now, if they want to come in and have further conversations, we can. And I have. Mm-hmm. I've had people that have come in and want to understand more fully why, and I've sat down with them. I've had people that want to understand more fully why it was affirmative, too, and I've done that as well. Yeah.
And what happens, okay, from what I know, two people have to still do all this paperwork or whatever. What happens if one just doesn't do it?
Ah, good question. What happens if one party doesn't do it? So that's going to be the respondent, right? So the petitioner is going to do their paperwork and they're going to send it to us. If the respondent does not respond to this, if they don't answer our questions, if they don't participate in the process, we move on. And now, sometimes I think people think, well, if I don't do anything, they can't get this. Not the case. We can move on without them. But it is going to slow us down a little bit. It's not going to stop us. It's going to slow us down. And it might make things more difficult. There, I can't tell you how many times I've had cases where, as I'm sitting there judging it, I think I would have benefited a lot from hearing from the other party and, you know, knowing what they have to say about these questions. But we can't force them to do it, so.
And no one reaches out to them to ask them.
We do.
Oh, you do?
We do. So we must reach out to the other party. So we have to cite, we call it citing the other party, that the case is not officially opened until we have cited the respondent. And we do that by mail, and we give them options. We send them a questionnaire, and we also, you know, ask for their input. Give them the opportunity to provide witnesses if they would like to suggest witnesses as well. We invite them to speak to the grounds that are being set. They're invited to review the testimony that's been provided. But some of them choose not to. So if we don't get anything back from them after a certain period of time, we will send them a certified letter so that we have documentation that they have been cited. Sometimes Cheryl will make a phone call, see if she can get on my phone. But after that, there's not really much we can do. After we've got documentation that they've been cited, we will continue to send them all of the updates. Whether or not they respond is up to them. Yeah. But we do make every attempt. And there are cases sometimes where people come in and they're like, I don't know where they are. Like, well, we need to be able to demonstrate that too. So we have to try and prove that by some way. So we have some methods that we use for that. But it is a requirement of the law that the respondent be given the right to participate in the process. So, yeah. How much do they cost? How many of you think they cost more than $1,000? And you're all wrong. They have never cost that much in our diocese. I think the most that they have ever been in the Diocese of Wichita is $350. Currently, we charge $100 for an annulment, and that is it. So when you have people telling you that they spent thousands of dollars to get an annulment, you can call bullshit on them. Because I do. I'm like, it's never cost that much. Now, are there places that are around the world where that has been the case? Yes. I don't know that it has necessarily been that case in the United States so much, but other places, it has been expensive. But yeah, in the Diocese of Wichita, we never charged more than $350, or maybe it was $375, something like that. Yeah.
So if someone that was married in the diocese that is now moved out of state, their annulment comes back to this diocese.
Good question. So the question was, if somebody got married in the diocese and then they've moved outside the state even, would their annulment come back to the Diocese of Wichita? Maybe. So there are three, four reasons that you can bring an annulment to a particular tribunal. Okay, so we are not competent to hear just any case for any person. We can hear cases for any marriage that took place in the Diocese of Wichita, no matter when or where the parties currently live. So we call that the place of the contract. So this is where the contract took place. We are competent to hear that case. Then it could also be the place where the petitioner lives or the place where the respondent lives. Okay? Now, that is also one of the changes that Pope Francis made to the law in 2016, because it was a little bit complicated. It used to be that you could always hear it at the place of the respondent, so their tribunal was always competent. The tribunal of the petitioner might be competent if you got permission from the judicial vicar of the tribunal of the respondent, and both parties lived within the jurisdiction of the same episcopal conference. So, for example, the respondent lived in Puerto Rico, and the petitioner lives here. Under that former law, we would never have been able to hear that case here unless the marriage had taken place here, because Puerto Rico is not in the same episcopal conference as Wichita. Even though it's U.S. territory, it is not in the USCCB. It's a different Episcopal conference. The place where it really affected us was when you had Hispanics. One of them lived here, one of them lived in Mexico. We actually had this when I first got into the tribunal. And one of our pastors at Hispanic Parish, the marriage had taken place in Mexico, the respondent lived in Mexico, the petitioner lived here. The tribunal in Mexico, they had approached them, they had sent it there, and it had been there for 3 years and was still at the very beginning stages. Nothing had happened with this case, essentially. Nothing had happened. And the pastor was asking me, and he said, well, what can we do? And I said, nothing. I said, there's nothing we can do. Well, then when the law changed, he called, he said, well, I don't know, what do we do? And I said, he has to renounce the case in Mexico. And once I have that in writing, that the case has been renounced and closed in Mexico, we can start it over here and he'll have to start over again, but we can do it here now. And we were able to get it done here. I think it would probably still be sitting in that tribunal in Mexico if we hadn't been able to do that. So, and then the final reason that we might be able to hear a case, to be competent for a case, is what they would call the form of the most proofs. So let's just say that all of the witnesses that you're going to call in a particular case lived in Wichita, but one party lived in Dodge City, the other party lives in Salina, and the marriage took place in Kansas City. Now, that's four different dioceses, four different tribunals, and actually any one of them would have been able to hear the case. So they would be able to just approach the tribunal that was closest or whatever they wanted to do, but yeah.
Can you give us some examples of you call it defective form and defective consent?
Examples of defective, defective form, I gave you that one we were talking about. So that would be one, or the easiest one in that case is they get married outside the church. That would be the most common reason that we see something considering defective form. In fact, we call it a lack of form case. It's a Catholic, one or both, and they get married outside the church without a dispensation. It's pretty easy, cut and dry. You could have a case where, a priest cannot just witness a marriage anywhere without permission. So Father Pat, by the fact that he is the pastor here, can witness any marriages at Sacred Heart. We'll take the Wichita out of it, but because priests in our diocese have been granted the faculty to hear witness marriages anywhere in the diocese, but that's not universal law. By the fact that I'm the neighboring pastor, I couldn't just come up and do a wedding here without him delegating me to witness the marriage here. Without that delegation, the marriage would be invalid, and that's a defective form. Now, all of the priests in the Diocese of Wichita have been granted the faculty to witness marriages anywhere in the Diocese of Wichita. So Bishop Gerber, I think, started that. He eliminated this problem. But, at least for us, if we have a priest coming from outside the diocese, he still needs to be delegated to witness a marriage in a place where it is invalid. So, Those are some easy ones. Defect of form. Defect of consent gets a little more complicated. Like I said, there's a number of different things that could go into it. One that I would just love to hear someday would be that they were not mentally capable, at all. That would be fun. I actually thought I was going to have one, but we couldn't prove it, so. And that wasn't because the guy was insane, it was because very, very heavy drug use. But we couldn't prove it, so we found another ground.
And I was disappointed.
When you start looking at them, they all look the same. When you get something, they're like, hey, this is fun. Something different. Sometimes you get people and they say that there's an idea that if somebody cheats, that the marriage is invalid. Well, they cheated on me. Okay. That's wrong, and they shouldn't do that, and that's sinful, and it's not necessarily invalidating, right? So we have what we call simulation. So if a person enters into marriage, not intending marriage, but something else, they are simulating marriage. So they're not actually entering marriage. Okay. that might be the case for somebody who is getting married for the purposes of legal status, or perhaps to, in their mind, legitimize a child. Okay? Could be. I'm not saying that every case that falls with that's absolute, right? These are just possible examples. And then you have all of these elements of marriage that are essential for marriage to be valid, and a person might not be excluding all of them, but just one. Okay, so I use the example of fidelity. If a person gets married intending to be faithful to their spouse, and then years down the road makes a really stupid decision and cheats on their spouse, that does not invalidate the marriage. If a person gets married intending to hold for themselves the option of, you know, finding somebody else down the road if they find somebody that's better looking than their spouse, but they never cheat on their spouse, that marriage is still invalid because they did not intend fidelity for at the beginning, at the moment of consent. Okay? Do you understand the distinctions there?
What's that?
How do you ever prove that?
Ah, that is an excellent question. You're most likely not going to be able to prove it, but it doesn't change the fact that a person must intend all of the things that are intended by marriage to enter into it validly. Now, we presume that what a person says in the exchange of consent that they intend. So what they're saying, we presume that they intend that. Now, if we're going to find that they didn't, we have to prove that. So to be able to prove something like that, they would probably have had it told other people, because there's probably not going to be any other way to do that. Okay? It could be the same for permanence. You know, they intend to hold an option for themselves. If, you know, they get bored in 5 years, or I mean, whatever. But so those are some simple things. You could have questions of fraud. So where somebody is intentionally deceived for the purpose of obtaining consent. So, you know, we'll have people that come to us and they're like, well, you know, this was fraud. They didn't tell me that they had an ingrown toenail. Like, well, maybe they were embarrassed by it, but I don't think that they withheld that for the purpose of obtaining consent, right? You know, whereas there might be something else that they, like, oh, I'm not going to tell them this because if I tell them this, they won't marry me. Now, that's for the purpose of obtaining consent, right? So.
And what about abuse? Sorry.
Yeah.
What about abuse? I mean.
Abuse.
That comes after.
Yes. So the abuse itself is not necessarily a ground for annulment. Now, absolutely, that is a reason why a person should do something to protect themselves, their children, everything else. You know, that is legitimate. But the abuse itself is probably symptomatic of something else that we're probably going to be examining in the question that they're there. But I mean, it would definitely come into play in our examination of the marriage, but it might not be the reason itself. And abuse is not a category of grounds that we have. Yeah. Yeah. Does it make a difference if it's an annulment to join the church or to get married? Well, no, they're the same process. We do give priority to cases for people who are in RCIA because of the time limits that they're on, because they're trying to come in at Easter. But we make no guarantees for that either. We've had annulments brought to us that are people that are in our RCIA currently. You know, keep in mind Easter's, you know, 2 weeks, right? Less than 2 weeks. we've had them brought to us within the last 2 weeks. And I'm like, and I just looked at the priest and said, you do realize this is not going to happen before Easter. And they're like, yeah, again, okay. So, now, depending on the person's circumstances, they may not have to have the annulment before they come into the church. I had one a few years ago. The guy came to us late, questioning the questions of an annulment. And I told him, I said, it's probably not going to happen before Easter. And I said, we can still bring you into the church as long as you understand that if this is a negative decision, you will not be able to get married in the church again. And he said, I understand that. So, okay, let's move on. Now, given the fact that I'm the judicial vicar and see all these, I had a pretty good idea he was going to get it. So I was not the judge, but yeah. But I didn't tell him that, okay? So, I never promised anybody anything. Yeah?
Does the church recognize all marriages or just one people ask for it? In other words,
two non-Catholics get married, we still presume that marriage to be valid. Yes. So, can we pursue an annulment for two people who were not Catholic? Yes. Typically, that only happens if one of them is either becoming Catholic or they're wanting to marry a Catholic. But otherwise, we, yeah. So the only reason that we are going to look at the question of the validity of a marriage is if somebody, one of the parties, brings that to us. We're not going to go out and pursue and say, oh, let's look at this person, and like, I think they have an invalid marriage. I want to explore their marriage. Nope, we're not going to do that. So, yeah.
Why, in your opinion, is it that the Catholic Church is one of very few religions that considers marriage a sacrament?
That's a good question, and I don't know that I necessarily have a full answer to that.
Father Pat, we can defer to him.
Yeah, make Father Pat answer that one. I think ultimately it comes down to the differences in sacramental theology. And our understanding of a sacrament. The Catholic Church is not the only one that views marriage as a sacrament, but it is a small handful. Yeah. So.
How often do you listen to these? Have these hearings? Like, give me an example. How many a month? What's typical?
The question is, how often do we have these hearings? Well, they're files that come across my desk, so that I don't know that there's any way to answer that. It's going to depend on the week, the month, that you know, and the judge and his availability. Because most of our judges take them and work on them at home. Even I do that sometimes. I refer to my dining room as Tribunal West, but yeah.
Just how busy are you? How many diocese was done? How many active cases are there?
How many active cases are there at any one time? We can answer this in a couple different ways, but we get about 100 cases a year, and we have a bit of a backlog with cases from things that, you know, something's happened or whatever, so we currently have about 300 active cases. Now, the majority of those probably are heading to abatement because nothing's happening with them. And we're not getting responses, and we're not getting, you know, but, yeah. So, but I could find out those exact numbers, because every year I do a report for the Signatura that tells how many cases came into us, how many cases were judged, and how many cases were abated. And then, so, you know, I get a starting number and then I have an ending number. But, yeah. So, good?
Okay.
Yep.
One last. It says, Pope Francis changed the rule. Who normally changes the rule? Can't able to change the rule in that big, thick book?
Who can change the rules in this big, thick book? Pope Francis. Yeah. So the Pope is the supreme legislator. Now, he does not do so on his own, but he is the only one that can actually change the law. So you may have caught fairly recently that they actually replaced an entire book of the Code of Canon Law. So it's been replaced. So this book is outdated, but it's my book. So, and actually, there's not one currently that has been published that is up to date. So, yep. Right. The terms divorce and annulment are not synonymous. That is correct. So as far as we would look at this, divorce is a civil matter. Now, there are civil annulments, which gets confusing for people sometimes. They're like, oh, I have an annulment. Like, from the tribunal? No, I got it from the courthouse. Yeah, that's a civil annulment. And those do happen for various reasons. We do not consider those the same thing, right? So, yeah, they're different. We actually require the parties to be civilly divorced before they approach the tribunal. We will not start a case until the civil divorce has been final for at least 1 year. And there are a number of reasons for that, but one of them is that we have to leave room for reconciliation. I have had more than one person, a couple in my time as a priest, who got divorced civilly and then came back and wanted to get remarried. Okay, so dealt with that more than once. And then there's a host of other reasons. But we will not take up an annulment for somebody until the divorce has been final for a year. Other questions? Yep.
Can you explain that it's not an annulment if the marriage never happened? How do you explain that it's not that it didn't happen, but it wasn't a sacrament at the same time?
Well, you could say that that while they entered into this moment, it was not a valid consent, right? It does get a little bit difficult for people, I think, sometimes. But if when we approach it with the attitude of saying, like, oh, it never happened, I think that makes it very difficult for people to then approach this saying, well, what happened to all of those years of my life that I gave to this experience? So, like, yes, you were there and you experienced this and you lived a common life together, but it was not shared sacramentally in the way the church would have intended. So... Is that your reminder that it's like there's a game coming up? I think Father Pat's calling it. Thank you, Father Brian. Let's thank Father Brian for